Well, put your space helmet on and make the calls. Jeff Sessel with us, and we're going to talk about his book, Mercury Rising, with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Jeff Sessel with us. Jeff, do you think we'll ever get back to those exciting space days that we had back in the 70s and 60s?
I think we have a lot of excitement ahead. I do think we've got a couple of space races, as we were discussing, and one is the space race between SpaceX and Blue Origin, and a lot of exciting new technology being developed between the two of them, which may help to land some Americans on the moon a few years from now and maybe take them beyond it. And we've got the space race that's heating up between the United States and China in particular. And it is always that threat from overseas that spurs the United States to really raise its game. And so I do think there's excitement ahead, although I think that there's probably nothing that's going to compete with those first ventures into space, the first orbit of the Earth, the first footstep on the moon.
And the other thing is the astronauts of the past, Mercury 7, for example, everybody knew their names. They were superstars. Today, I think hardly anybody knows any astronaut's name.
Well, we have many astronauts now. I mean, in a way, it's a sign of the success of the program that we have had so many Americans in space. And of course, not just Americans have gone into space. Project Mercury, the astronauts, as we've been discussing, they were introduced to the world in April of 1959. And more than 2 years passed before Alan Shepard became the first American in space. And during those 2 years, they were the only astronauts we'd ever had. They all became national figures. They were on the cover of Life magazine. They were in the newsreels. And the public was watching their every move to see when they were finally going to get into space. So that kind of intense focus, it didn't even last the decade. I mean, we don't know all the names of astronauts today, but there were astronauts who walked on the moon that a year or two later, Americans couldn't tell you who there were. That there just was not the same kind of attention being paid. And, of course, there were more people to keep track of, more people to get to know. And it started to get a little blurry for people.
I mean, there are six astronauts right now aboard the ISS from all over the place. Nobody knows who they are.
No, it's true, and of course, what they're doing is incredible and worthy of our attention, but there are a lot of distractions here on Earth, and we are frankly used to the idea that we have astronauts floating up there on the space station.
They say the ISS is as big as a six-bedroom house. That's a pretty good size, isn't it?
It is pretty good, although I guess if you never got to leave your six-bedroom house for a year, you might feel differently about it, although I guess that's the situation a lot of us have been in here on Earth, and we don't always have six bedrooms.
The past year, we've all been trained to be astronauts, basically.
That's right. We've been in our own sort of isolation.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Mike in Denver, Colorado. Welcome to the program. Hi, Michael.
Good morning, George. Well, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
And Jeff, congratulations on the new book, and thank you so much for being here tonight. This has been so interesting, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I just had a quick comment and question tonight. So, Jeff, we know the original Mercury launch. It was originally scheduled for December of 1961, and then it was pushed to January 13th due to kind of the problems with this new Atlas rocket that actually served as the space capsule's launching pad, and it caused this 2-week delay. And then, you know, we know the launch was again delayed on January 30th after a fuel leak was discovered, followed by this other weather delay. And, you know, it didn't actually launch until February 20th of 1962. It was said that John Glenn experienced a lot of anxiety in this one-year period, over was this going to be a successful launch or not. And Jeff, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on this period of time when everything with this launch was kind of in limbo for John Glenn.
Well, it's a great question, and it's a really important period to look at because I think it's hard to understand the enormous response that the American public and also people overseas had to Glenn's success after his flight if you don't take a look at what you've just described, this period of endless, seemingly endless delays. During this 4-month period, the launch was scrubbed 10 times.
Oh my gosh. That's
10 times it was scrubbed, and for all sorts of reasons. As you've just heard, there were problems with the rocket. There were problems with the capsule. There were problems with Glenn's spacesuit. It was leaking oxygen out of the little ring that held the glove onto the rest of the suit. And then there were problems again and again with the weather. And the weather actually had to be pretty perfect in certain areas, because if there was a problem with the launch and Glenn had to fire the escape rocket and the capsule splashed down, well, you couldn't have it splash down into raging seas. And so the weather had to be good. So it just seemed that for one reason or another, this was not happening. And Glenn, as calm as he was for a good long time, and as calm as he always continued to be in public, Glenn was really starting to face the fact that he might become the first American to die in space. It started to seem that everything that could go wrong was going wrong. And I think the most remarkable document that I found in the Glenn archives at Ohio State, which is where he gave his papers, was a script that he wrote for a recording that he made for his kids. His kids were teenagers at the time. And he begins by saying, "If you hear this, I've been killed." This was a recording that was going to be played for them if he didn't come back alive. And he talks to them about his faith. He talks to them about his views of the afterlife. He even tells them that he's going to send them a signal, and he specifies what the signal is, from heaven, so that they know that he's okay. And he also wants them to believe that the sacrifice of his life was worth it, that it was to advance human progress, and that it was to advance the interests of the United States. It is a very deeply personal and, frankly, chilling letter to read. And he made this recording for his kids and made one for his wife, Annie, as well.
And I would guess most of the astronauts were prepared to die, don't you?
They were. I mean, these were military test pilots, every single one of them. And some of them had been in combat, like John Glenn.
That's right.
And they had seen death all around them. They knew every time they got up in a plane. They might not think it's going to happen to me, but they lived with that possibility.
They're prepared for it.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the interesting and also chilling things that I learned in the course of this is that the Mercury 7 astronauts, at one point early on, when the rockets were having such difficulty, they had a meeting, and they agreed that it was inevitable that one of them was going to die in one of these space flights. And it was just a question of which one and when.
Let's go to Mark in Maryland. Welcome to the program. Hi, Mark.
Thank you so much, George. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mark.
Dovetailing directly into what I was going to about to say, we lost three astronauts that we didn't necessarily have to lose. Virgil I, Gus Grissom, Edward H. White, and rookie astronaut Roger B. Chaffee, who were the crew named for Apollo 1, AS-204, later renamed Apollo 1. JFK had a lot of hands-on participation in the early development of the Apollo spacecraft, which was having problems, admittedly, a three-man craft, all new. He visited Cape Canaveral at least once to meet Dr. Wernher von Braun, and actually there's footage of him entering into a mock-up of an Apollo spacecraft. Although he did not live to see his dream come true, it's quite unfortunate that we lost those three I mentioned on a launch pad in a simulated plugs-out countdown. My question is this. Had John Glenn, or did John Glenn, was he ever asked, or did he have any participation at all in the development of the Apollo spacecraft?
Well, he resigned in 64, so what do you think, Jeff? I don't think so.
Well, he was involved early on. So each of the astronauts, the Mercury astronauts, was given one kind of domain, one area that they were supposed to specialize in to help work with the engineers and provide the astronauts collective input in developing the capsule. And Glenn's responsibility was the cockpit of the Mercury capsule. So he spent a lot of time working with the engineers on that. So after his spaceflight in 62, he continues to work with the engineers on what becomes the Gemini capsule and some very early preliminary designs for an Apollo capsule. But you're right, George. He's really out of the program before that development begins in earnest.
Bill in Los Angeles, take it away, Bill. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Mr. Norrie. Hey, Jeff, can you write me a presidential disclosure speech on my contacts with UFOs? Unbelievably foxy office workers.
Well, gosh, I think you can probably write your own statement, it sounds like.
Well, we're expecting a big one coming up on June 25th, Jeff.
Yes, well, we're all waiting to see what we learn.
So who knows what's going to happen in those days? Were you born by the time the Mercury launches were happening?
I was not. I was actually born just a little more than a week after Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin set foot on the moon.
Wow, those were amazing times, I got to tell you. I mean, I remember the moon landing with my dad, watching on the little black and white television set we had. I mean, it was just exciting. It was just, you know, watching him come down with that grainy black and white, you know, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. It was exciting times.
I can only imagine. I mean, it's exciting to watch the films now, even all these years later. I can only imagine what it was like.
I was on Larry King's show with Buzz Aldrin a few years ago before Larry got off CNN, and he has since passed on. But it was just cool to be next to a guy who was on the moon.
Absolutely.
I knew Edgar Mitchell, too.
I had the chance to meet him once myself, Buzz Aldrin, back in the 90s. I was in college, and I was interning at a radio station in Denver where I'm from, and he came in to do an interview. I think he had just written a book, and I got to shake his hand. And yeah, it is it's a remarkable thing. I mean, it still is after all this time.
Just don't ask him if he went to the moon. Pop. Well, we knew Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14, and he was a staunch believer in extraterrestrial life. That was kind of cool to hear that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, some of the astronauts, I think there's a wide range of views among the astronauts.
We're going to take some more calls, and we'll take calls next half hour. Bob in Manhattan, New York, welcome to the program. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
First of all roads lead to Rome. The Vatican controls everything, and the Jesuits control the space program.
That's it? Well, that's it. No need for a comment on that there, Jeff. Jeff, you think?
I don't have a comment on that, but thank you.
Next up, Fred in Reno, Nevada. Fred, take it away.
Yeah, I've got a little bit of irony regarding the program manager for Mercury and Gemini project.
Okay.
I've forgotten what his name is, but he was killed in the crash of a Piper Apache or Aztec while shooting the approach to the Ukiah airport. He and the prospective buyer had landed at Santa Rosa, California airport, and then decided to continue on up after refueling, and they flew up to Ukiah and shot the approach there in a heavy rainstorm, heavy storm at the time. And the pilot failed to change the DME channel from the Ukiah VORTAC, which was on the initial approach, to the Ukiah localizer DME. And they struck a hill as they were on the approach. I heard them fly over the airport, and a few moments later, they struck this hill to the south of town. And the problem was that the pilot forgot to change the DME channel from the VORTAC to the localizer DME. And the corrective action, FA-wide, was to change the name of a VORTAC whenever the VORTAC is not on the same field. But it was odd because the name of the pilot, and I've forgotten what it is, it was the same as the road that off of Highway 101 that led to the crash site.
How weird, huh?
Yeah, really, really a strange one. But I've forgotten his name, and your author would probably know that, but I have it somewhere.
Do you remember some of the astronauts that got involved in a plane crash? Was it McDivitt, Jeff?
I believe one was named C. SEE, Apollo astronauts. There were two who had died in a plane crash in the mid-60s. But I don't have the details. I don't have the details down on that.
Not yet. We take text and tweets. Tom, what do you have for Jeff?
This one in from John in Texas. He says, can the guest talk about the mental state an astronaut has to get in before launch?
Absolutely. I think one of the remarkable things, and this was true of John Glenn, it was true of Alan Shepard, it was true really of all of the astronauts that we talked about, is that they kept pretty calm. They kept pretty calm because these were incredibly experienced test pilots. They were familiar with the feeling of going up on an experimental aircraft. Here, this was an experimental spacecraft, and they knew what it was like to face danger. And they also had the experience of running simulations on the flight plan that they were going to follow, more times than they could possibly stand. And so one of the things that you hear from Alan Shepard and Glenn and all of them when they come back is that it felt like this was something that they'd done 1,000 times. They were familiar with every motion that they were supposed to take. Now, of course, when you're in the capsule, then things sometimes go wrong, and there's change in the plan, and you've got to react. But again, this is a group of pilots that had those skills and were able to keep their cool. So I think in terms of the mental state, there was a calm readiness, a calm alertness, if that makes sense, that all of them were able to summon in those moments before launch.
The two astronauts that died in the NASA plane crash, you are correct. Elliot C. was one, and then his partner, Charles Bassett. They crashed in St. Louis at the McDonnell aircraft area.
That's right.
Tragic. I guess there have been like 18 astronauts that have died either in space or in relationship to the program over time. That seems like a lot, doesn't it?
It does seem like a lot. I think it is remarkable that, I mean, as I said before, the Mercury 7 were sure that one of them would die over the course of Project Mercury. In fact, none of them did. Gus Grissom, who died in that horrible fire that was discussed a little while ago, the Apollo 1 fire, that, of course, was much later. That was 1967. So they did manage to make it through Mercury without losing the life of an astronaut. They very nearly lost Gus Grissom, as you may know, when Gus Grissom's capsule
splashed. He almost drowned, didn't he?
He almost drowned. Yeah, the hatch blew. There was some sort of problem, and he had to get out of the capsule, which was taking on water and sinking, and then he was taking on water.
That's right. He would have gone down with the capsule, which eventually they raised. And it's in a museum somewhere, isn't it?
They did that relatively recently. It's quite incredible.
We're going to come back and take final calls with you in a moment, Jeff, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Next hour, Jesus Christ movie star. We're going to talk about how Hollywood depicts Jesus. Phil Hall back with us. He also wrote a book called The Weirdest Movie Ever Made, the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot film. Remember that? We'll talk a little bit about that, too. So I'm looking forward to that. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Jeff Sessions. Jeff, when you were writing the book Mercury Rising, how did you find all the information that you found?
Well, thankfully, John Glenn not only kept a lot of notes, but he saved his notes. And then ultimately, he donated them to Ohio State.
Ah.
And so I had in hand, and it's just an incredible thing as a historian to have a gift like this come to you from decades ago. John Glenn's diaries during World War II, the diary that he kept with him in the South Pacific, his letters home from Korea, and his notes throughout the space program. He scribbled notes in the margins of his flight plans when he was preparing himself for what was going to be a contentious meeting with the flight directors. He would scribble his notes out on note cards and bring those into the meeting with him. And so It really gives you an amazing window into what he was thinking and feeling at any given point. And so that was an enormously valuable source. And There were others. Oral histories that were recorded. He recorded many, many hours of oral histories, covering the whole of his life. And then I did interviews. I interviewed both of his children. I interviewed engineers who were there in mission control the day of Glenn's flight. And I interviewed folks who I actually interviewed a wonderful guy named Robert Vose, who was a Navy psychologist, who helped to develop the list of criteria by which we would even choose an astronaut before we had a single astronaut. He helped to pick John Glenn.
Was there anything that you came across that you found shocking that you didn't know before?
Well, that script that I described to you before, the script that for the recording that was to be played for his kids if he didn't come back alive, that was shocking.
Okay.
Something else that was really very surprising to me was that on the eve of Glenn's flight, I mentioned a moment ago a contentious meeting with his NASA managers. Right on the eve of his flight, there was a lot of back and forth between Glenn and NASA officials about whether or not he was going to have to leave the autopilot running for the whole of the trip, other than occasionally checking the manual control just to see if it worked. And he wrote some pretty frank notes. He said, and keep in mind, this is Glenn about to become the first American to try to orbit the Earth, to ride that Atlas rocket that had been exploding in previous tests. And he writes in his notes, "I've never felt so alone. I thought I'd have more help. Why?" And he underlines the word "why" a couple of times. And this is a tough moment for him. He feels very isolated on the eve of his flight.
That's kind of riveting.
It is riveting. You know, I didn't know when I got into this project that I was going to be able to reconstruct events in this way, because you don't know what the written record is. And you don't know what people will remember. So I felt very, very lucky as I got into this. I wanted to be sure that I had something new to add to this story, or it wasn't worth my writing it. And I found that there was a lot to be added here.
Let's go back to the calls. Michael in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for having Jeff on.
Thank you.
Jeff, the reason that the Soviets beat us into space is because they were atheists, and they were determined that their only way of dominating the world as atheistic communists was through technology. John Kennedy responded to that. But the Soviets went on to convert and recruit.
Come back to your phone, Mike. Your voice is fading on me.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Soviets went on to convert and recruit the grandfather of the current dictator of North Korea. They went on to convert and recruit Mao Zedong. And as a result, we have these atheists beating us in their drive for total domination, beating us in technology in many areas, according to top security experts in America. So here is the problem. We as a country, populated almost entirely by Protestants at the beginning, have our strongest growth in the Protestant area coming from my fellow evangelicals right here in Virginia Beach, the rest of Virginia and Lynchburg, and across the nation. Now, I love these people. I grew up with them. My grandfather was a Baptist preacher. But here's the problem. They are not understanding the necessity of technology in the Christian world to fulfill the prophecies of the Bible. We must excel there and dominate there in order to welcome Christ back in the proper way, not as the slaves of the world's atheists.
Interesting take. I didn't think you thought of that angle, did you, Jeff?
Well, I did not think of that angle, but there's something in what was said a minute ago that brings to mind an interesting irony.
Kind of prophetic.
Why the Soviets were leading. And that is that we were awed by their technology, but actually the reason that the Soviets were able to jump to this early lead in the space race was because they actually had very backwards rocket technology. They had something called the Semyorka rocket, which was a big...
Well, they were huge.
...clunky, thuggish rocket that was actually pretty ineffective as a weapon. It was huge, and it was difficult to aim, and it was difficult to move and maneuver, and it was not very effective as a weapon. But one thing that it could do is push things very high.
It was great for payloads.
Yes, exactly. And so they were able to push heavy objects, like a satellite or ultimately a capsule with a human being in it, out of the atmosphere. Whereas the United States had been developing really advanced missile technology during the late 40s and the early 1950s, these sleek and very effective missiles that would deliver, if need be, a nuclear payload, but they were not meant to carry a heavy load.
I don't think their non-religious background, though, had anything to do with their abilities to get into space, do you?
No, I don't think that was a driver here. I mean, the Soviet Union was looking to dominate militarily and to catch up economically, and they understood that making a good show of it in space would convince both their adversaries, like the United States, and also even the citizens of the Soviet bloc, that they were making huge advances. It was a little bit of a Potemkin program. I mean, the truth of it was that as spectacular as these achievements were in space, they did not mean that the Soviet Union as a whole was moving forward technologically.
Let's go to Don in Louisiana. Welcome to the show. Hey, Don, go ahead. Still with us? Nope, he is not there. Let us go to Ron in Temple, Texas. Hey, Ron, it is your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Hi, Jeff and George, a great show and great guest. I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you.
I had a little clarification going back to some of the astronauts that tragically died during the program. Elliot C., mentioned before by Jeff, was actually one of the next nine selected, along with Armstrong and Borman and Young and some of the rest of them. But he and another astronaut called Charlie Bassett.
Charlie Bassett.
Flying a T-38 to St. Louis there for the McDonnell Douglas plant where they were, I believe they were actually building components of the service module.
Yeah, Apollo
service module.
That's where they crashed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was horrible weather, and they crashed into the building where they were actually building the service module, I believe it was. And there was another pilot, astronaut named C.C. Williams that also, I believe, died in the T-38 crash. And then the fourth one was named Ted Freeman that was flying to Houston to the old Air Force Base, I believe it was called Ellington Air Force Base at the time, had bird strike. And got killed.
Wasn't there an astronaut named McDivitt?
Yes, absolutely.
What happened to him? Did he survive?
I believe so, but I think we should ask someone who knows.
Well, the Google will know.
Yeah, that's right.
Tom is truck driving in California. Thanks for holding, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Jeff, how you doing?
Great.
Good.
Hey, as growing up, I watched all these stuff on TV, and actually I got to work on the USS Hornet when they were decommissioning it, and they turned it into a museum, and then on the day of the opening, I got to meet Buzz Aldrin, and that was quite an experience. I just wanted to share that with you guys.
It's a cool feeling, isn't it, meeting an astronaut like that?
Oh, yeah, and especially when I was born in 1963, and I grew up watching all that glued in front of the TV, and then, you know, in West Virginia, and then when you're growing as an adult, you get to meet that person. It's a trip.
Yeah, it really is. It really
yeah,
is. And,
so,
and he's, anyway, you know, he's a tough guy, but he's a nice guy.
Yes, he is. It was a great experience meeting him.
Absolutely.
So, But anyway, great show. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the story. Appreciate it as well. Jeff, if there was an astronaut living or dead that you could meet, who would it be?
Gosh, well, it's too obvious that I would say John Glenn.
I was just going to say that.
I did meet him once. I got to shake his hand. I can't say that we had a meaningful conversation. It was at an event, and it was really just a handshake. But of course, I'd have many, many questions to ask him. But you know, I think one of the astronauts who intrigues me the most is Neil Armstrong, and that might seem obvious too. I mean, of course, the first man to set foot on the moon. But I think what's interesting to me about Neil Armstrong is how sort of quiet he was, and how he was never interested in going out and talking much or trading on his experiences. And there was something very intense and private about him, and I think it would be a challenge to draw him out in a conversation if he were still with us. But I think if you were able to do that, it would be incredibly rewarding. Again, not just because he was first, but because he seemed to think very deeply about the experience that he had.
Let's see if we can squeeze in one more call. Mike in Florida. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi there. I have two questions, actually. Well, maybe one if there's only
Let's go with one first. Go ahead.
Okay, that's fair enough. There was two really great test pilots early on, Chuck Yeager and Scott Crossfield, and they had distinguished themselves and gained notoriety. And in the movie, they were left out of the space program, I guess, because of maybe a lack of education or something. I'm not sure what the reason was, but they were outstanding test pilots. And I remember there was a show in New York called Wonderama with Sonny Fox was the host. And he tried to get Scott Crossfield on the phone back then, and he couldn't get on the phone. I guess that happens in live television. And I was just curious if you knew anything about that, why they were not considered to be the Gemini astronauts as well.
Well, I know of Scott Crossfield, certainly. I don't know about the circumstances of his education, but you're absolutely right that there was a requirement that you had to have a college degree in order to serve as an astronaut. That was one of a whole series of requirements. And so certainly there were some talented test pilots who fell by the wayside because they hadn't met that requirement. There were others as well, other test pilots who walked away from the opportunity because they didn't like the sound of it. All of those famous complaints, they were made famous by The Right Stuff, it was not a complaint, it was a mocking that the astronaut would just be spam in a can, that they were doing a job that monkeys could do, and in fact monkeys were already doing, which was just to ride as a passenger in this tin can that they flung up outside the atmosphere. And so there were some test pilots who turned up their nose at the program and thought, it's beneath me, and it's an embarrassment to a good pilot to have to suit up in this way and be made into a guinea pig.
Was Yeager one of them?
Yeager did take that attitude toward the program, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Jeff, what's your next project?
Good question. I don't know the answer to it yet. I'm so enjoying going out and talking to folks like you about this book that I haven't thought beyond that, but I will soon.
All right, my friend. Well done. Keep in touch. Up next, Jesus Christ movie star. What is Hollywood doing to Jesus?